general impression of Micah, my fifth general impression is connected with the letter E, holy mercy. Holy mercy. The book of Micah is a wonderful illustration of this fact, that God's mercy is a holy mercy. In other words, God does not have mercy upon us at the expense of his holiness, but he has mercy upon us in terms of his holiness. Now, of course, what book in the New Testament, above all others, emphasizes that? That God's mercy is a holy mercy, and he doesn't have mercy on us at the expense of his holiness, but in terms of his holiness. What book of the New Testament, above all others, gives that emphasis? I think you would spot one, wouldn't you? What particular book? See, God, how can he be just and at the same time justifier of the ungodly? That's what book? Book of Romans. I think when you think it through and see what I'm trying to say, you'll think of the book of Romans. Above all others, it gives that emphasis. But the prophets in general give that emphasis, and Micah gives that emphasis in a wonderful way. God's mercy is a holy mercy. He doesn't have mercy on us at the expense of his holiness, but in terms of his holiness. Now, the book of Jonah shows that God did not have mercy upon the heathen, upon Nineveh, at the expense of his holiness. But God had mercy on the heathen, Nineveh, in terms of his holiness. Now, Micah follows, and Micah shows that God does not have mercy upon Israel at the expense of his holiness. But God has mercy upon Israel in terms of his holiness. One thing that drives this home is that the book of Micah closes with one of the most wonderful descriptions of God's mercy in the entire Bible. Listen while I read the last three verses of Micah in chapter 7, verses 18 to 20. This is one of the greatest descriptions of God's holy mercy in the Bible. Micah 7, 18 to 20. Who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity and passeth over the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in loving kindness. He will again have compassion upon us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Now, if you forget where those words are, just remember they're almost the last words of the book of Micah. That's one of my favorite descriptions of God's holy mercy in the Bible. Thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. You see why that's such a strong figure? Because the sea was the deepest thing that Micah knew anything about. And he took the deepest thing he knew anything about as a figure of God's holy, forgiving mercy. You know how deep the sea is in some places. Of course, there are some depths of the sea that have never been sounded. They've never been able to find how deep the sea is in some places because their instruments won't tell them. But this is the latest information I have. Of course, as they keep on with new inventions, you may have bigger figures shown, but no figure will be less than this. You know how deep the sea is in some places? As founded by the instrument, 7 miles. That's my figure. Now, you know, when we're advancing to the moon and all, we can expect most anything to happen with present-day invention and discovery. But if you want to know how deep the sea is, 7 miles. Sometimes watch the speedometer of your automobile as you're going along horizontally on the ground. Measure off 7 miles. And then just try to visualize that distance of 7 miles and you're going straight up and down. And all, nothing but water in between, you see. Well, that's your figure. And all, what a strong figure it is. I read one time of a Christian man who was studying a book on geography. And he interrupted himself right in the middle of it. And he said, "Praise the Lord." And somebody said to him, "I can see why you praise the Lord when you're reading the Bible, but not when you're reading an old dry book on geography." He said, "The reason why I was praising the Lord was that I read in the book of Micah that God has buried my sins in the depths of the sea. And I read in this book on geography that the sea is 7 miles deep." And that's what thrilled me so. Well, you see, that's almost the last statement in the book of Micah. And it's God's holy mercy. God doesn't have mercy on us at the expense of his holiness. But God has mercy on us and turns it over. Jonah applies that especially to the heathen city of Nineveh. Martha applies that especially to Israel, the people of God. On page 79, our second principle is seek to get a bird's eye view of the book of Micah as a whole. Give your own heading to each part of the following outline of Micah. Chapters 1 to 3, chapters 4 and 5, 6, 1 to 7, 6, and 7, 7 to 20. I think you see how simple this outline is if you just build it around the contrasting pictures and repetition. In the first section, he gives one picture, and then in the second, he gives the contrasting picture. Then in the third section, he comes back to the first point. And then in the last section, he comes back to the second point. Chapters 1 to 3 may be summarized in four simple words: self-rule and its consequences. What are the consequences of self-rule? Make a hyphenated word out of that, if you will. When you rule yourself. Well, that's the first three chapters. Self-rule and its consequences. Then chapters 4 and 5 describe the true ruler, Christ himself. You see, this passage has two great messianic sections in it, one in chapter 4 and one in chapter 5. And you see the relation of these to the central message of Micah? The relation is, what's the cure for self-rule? Chapters 1 to 3 show the awful consequences of self-rule. I told you about that figure of the cannibal thief. Israel acting like a bunch of cannibals, in extreme form of cannibalism. What's the cure for that? And the answer is the true ruler, Christ himself. Christ as the ruler is the cure for self-rule. Then you return to the first point in Micah 6:1 to 7:6. And you have again a description of self-rule and its consequences. Then in the last part of chapter 7, verses 7 to 20, you come back again to the cure for self-rule in the true rule. And that's just the picture of Micah. It's the contrast between self-rule and Christ's rule. Self-rule and Christ's rule. That's the great burning message, the great burning appeal of the book. Shall I repeat that? Chapters 1 to 3, self-rule and its consequences. Chapters 4 and 5, the true rule. 6:1 to 7:6, self-rule and its consequences. 7:7 to 20, the true rule. From your answer to the above question, and any knowledge of the book you possess, mention this stuff what you believe to be the central message of the book of Micah. I just like to summarize it in this simple statement. Christ rule, the cure for self-rule. Again, make that a hyphenated word, Christ rule, and self-rule is a hyphenated word. Christ rule, the cure for self-rule. Now, of course, this takes you right into the center of what we call the Lordship of Christ. What is meant by the Lordship of Christ? It means simply the rulership of Christ, the rule of Christ. It's interesting that the Hebrew word for Lord is Adonai, A-D-O-N-A-I. And that Hebrew word Adonai comes from the root Don, D-O-N, which means to rule. What does it mean to be Lord? To be Lord just means to be ruler. How does Micah cause me to know Christ? Micah causes me to know Christ as the Lord. He causes me to know Christ as the ruler. It's all important to realize that with an infinite longing, Jesus Christ longs to rule my individual life. With an infinite longing, Jesus Christ longs to rule your individual life. But more than that, with an infinite longing, Jesus Christ longs to rule the church. Have you ever heard anybody try to protect the coming millennial kingdom with this idea? I've heard some make this statement, and it just isn't scripture. The statement is, nowhere in the Bible is Christ called the King of the church. He's going to be king when he comes to earth one day, but he's not king over the church. The Bible never calls him king over the church. Now, of course, whenever you find something like that in the Thessalonians, try to get into the spirit of what they're saying. You know, when you combat something, just be sure you're against the thing and what it says and the spirit of it. But I can see the spirit of what they're saying is they're trying to protect the coming kingdom of Christ against amillennialism. And they say Christ has never called the king over the church, but all that isn't true. For example, you take Colossians 1:13. Colossians 1:13 says, He delivered us out of the power of darkness and translated us into the kingdom of His dear Son. Well, of course, if you're in the kingdom of His dear Son, He's your king. You don't have to use just exact phraseology. You know, I love that expression. That's one of my favorite titles for Christ in the Bible. Colossians 1:13, the kingdom of His dear Son. God's dear Son. He's my king. He's my king. And that's the cure for self-rule. Yet with an infinite longing, Christ longs to rule my individual life and longs to rule over the church. With an infinite longing, He longs to rule over the nation of Israel. To illustrate this, go back in your mind to the days of the theocracy. Theocracy means the rule of God. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, there was a theocracy in Israel. There's no more theocracy in Israel. But all with an infinite longing, Christ longs to rule over the nation Israel. And more than that, with an infinite longing, Jesus Christ longs to rule over all the nations of the world. Now that's what I mean by getting into the spirit of a book. There are lots of individual passages we're going to examine in Micah. But let's get into the spirit of it right from the beginning. It's one thing just to have a passive willingness for Christ to be king. It's another thing to have a great passion for Christ to be king. Young people, do you have a passion for Christ to be king in every part of your life? Do you have a passion for Christ to be king over the church? Do you have a passion for Christ to be king over Israel? Do you have a passion for Christ to be king over the whole world? Oh, that's what God is longing to accomplish in our lives through the study of Micah. The great appeal of the book of Micah can be expressed in these three words. Let Christ rule. Let Christ rule. Not man rule, but Christ rule. In England many years ago, a man went to a Christian Life convention. And when he came home from that Christian Life convention, he was asked, did you receive a great blessing from him? His answer was, oh, I received more than a blessing from him. You know, sometimes when God really meets you, the idea of just receiving a blessing seems so mild in contrast to what He's really done. And he said, I'll tell you the difference between my life now and what it used to be. He said, before I went to that Christian Life convention, Christ was my king after a fashion. But it was a constitutional sovereignty in my life. Christ was my king and I was His prime minister. But he said, what that convention meant was that now there's no longer a constitutional sovereignty, but there's an absolute monarchy in my life. That's the great message of Micah. Let there be an absolute monarchy in your life. Then when there is, that's going to answer these social problems. That's going to answer these social questions. Draw a diagram which will help you to see the book of Micah as a whole. My diagram for Micah revolves around the contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. And here's my diagram for self-rule. It's just a thinly shaded crown. See, we use the thickly shaded crown for Christ-rule, God-rule. The thinly shaded crown for self-rule, and then inside it, I just have the big capital pronoun, I. And then my diagram for Christ-rule is a thickly shaded crown with a cross inside the crown. And more in detail for the general plan of Micah, I have four of these. And these four correspond to the fourfold outline up at the top of the page. Watch. Here's the 80 part of the outline. Self-rule and its consequences. Just a thinly shaded crown with eyes inside. Then, here's the B part of the outline. Christ quiet rule is the cure for self rule. Then here's the key part of the eye. Just come back again to your thinly shaded crown and the eye inside. Self rule is consequences. And then here's the deep part of the outline. You come back again to Christ rule as the cure for self rule. And that's my simple diagram for the book of Micah. Don't live like this, but live like this. And then the book of Micah is going to show us how to live that way. The third principle is to note the place of Micah in the canon of Scripture. First, I want to show you why Micah logically follows Jonah, and then we'll put him into the overall diagram of the 12 minor prophets. First, he follows Jonah, because why would you teach Jonah and then go right into Micah? This is a logical relationship. It's because, you see, here's Jonah just filled with this self-righteousness. The anti-missionary heart of man over against the missionary heart of God. But now do you see, how does Micah take you right into the message of Jonah? I like to call Micah the how book. Micah shows me how to have the true experience. How can I be delivered from the anti-missionary heart of man? How can I know the missionary heart of God? What answer does Micah give to that? Micah's answer is, let Christ rule. Let Christ rule. And when Christ rules, then I'm delivered from the anti-missionary heart of man, and I know the meaning of the missionary heart of God. Now you see, one reason why Micah's the climax is that he's so messianic. Jonah's not messianic the same way in which Micah is. It's true that Jonah's a great type of Christ. See, in typology, but those people wouldn't understand that. But in the actual message, Jonah's not messianic in the same way Micah is. But how can I know the missionary heart of God? The answer is through the second person of the Godhead. Through Christ, let him rule. Then when Christ rules, I know the missionary heart of God rather than the anti-missionary heart of man. Now with that in mind, look at our overall diagram to show the relation of Micah to the minor prophets as a whole. First, we start with our two foundational books. The foundation of the prophetic message, the brokenhearted mother God in Hosea, and then the sovereignty of God in Jonah. And you'll notice that I make this unusually thick to show that Hosea is the starting point. The starting point is the sovereignty of God. The starting point is the brokenhearted love of God. And then it leads on in the sovereignty of God. Then we have these five books. Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, and Nahum, giving the minus side, the negative side of the prophetic message. And we call these five books the enemies of the prophetic message. First, here's Amos, unrighteousness in general. Then you go to the more particular. Obadiah, pride in particular. Jonah, anti-missionary selfishness. You see that eye heart that cuts us off from a world that needs Christ. Then, Micah. And you see, here's the diagram that you put here. It's just a thinly shaded crown with the eye inside the crown. What's the great enemy of the prophetic message is self-rule. Now, I want you to notice how this negative message of Micah is related to the preceding book. And then I want you to notice how the positive message of Micah is related to the preceding book. First, take the negative message, self-rule. Why? What's the cause of unrighteousness in general? Here's the answer. Self-rule. That's the cause. What's the cause of pride? The answer is self-rule. And the answer is self-rule. All right, I'm going to take the positive message of Micah, and we give that positive message in terms of this diagram, the shaded crown and the cross, and that's Christ rule. What's the cure for this? Unrighteousness in general. The answer is Christ rule. What's the cure for this? Pride. And the answer is this, Christ rule.
entrance of faith right through. You see what I mean when I say that Micah is the climax of these other books. It clinches them and drives them home. And one thing that makes it so climactic is that it's so messianic. It specifies the second person of the Godhead. You know, we talked about the missionary heart of God, and that's very important, but I'll never know the missionary heart of God apart from the second person of Godhead. And you see, Micah, with his great messianic emphasis, just drives home the messages of these earlier books. On page 80, we have our fourth contribution. Ask God to open your heart completely to the distinctive contribution of the book of Micah. I believe the distinctive contribution of Micah lies in the fact that of all the books in the entire Bible, it's the most compact summary of the contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. Of all the books in the entire Bible, Micah is the most compact summary. Now, you've got a lot of this in other books, but Micah is the most compact summary of the contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. I remember Dr. McCrookin used to speak so often on Philippians 1:21, to me to live as Christ. And one thing that made it so pointed was that he emphasized this difference. To me to live as Christ, to me to live as self. There's no middle ground. There's no middle ground. And that's one thing that makes Micah such spiritual dynamite. It's to me to live as Christ, to me to live as self. There's no middle ground. May I repeat it, of all books in the entire Bible, it's the most compact summary of the contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. Now this may help you if you realize that the book of Micah is to the prophetical book what 1st and 2nd Samuel are to the historical book. What relation does 1st and 2nd Samuel have to the historical book? The same relation that Micah has to the prophetical book. Micah, more than any other, gives that contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. And 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, more than any of the other historical books, give that great contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. See if you can tell me, who's the great individual mentioned and emphasized in 1 and 2 Samuel as a picture of self-rule? And who's the great individual in 1 and 2 Samuel who is the picture of Christ-rule? Oh, the tremendous contrast between these two. One is King Saul, and the other is King David. And one thing that makes that so graphic is this. Saul, in self-rule, is a great type of the Antichrist. A great foreshadowing of the final Antichrist. And it's just King Saul in his ultimate. That's what the Antichrist is going to be. David, you see, is a great type of Christ. And the great challenge I get from the contrast between those two men is this. Be a type of Antichrist or be a type of Christ. There's no middle ground. Everybody here in Christ today is a type. You're either a type of Antichrist or you're a type of Christ. I'm either a type of Antichrist or I'm a type of Christ. There's no middle ground. You see, this comparison with 1st and 2nd Samuel just helps to show you how emphatic is this contrast. Since God just has to knock you in the head to let you realize how awful it is not to make Christ Lord of all. And he uses all sorts of shocking comparisons. I've never read this anywhere, but oh, I can just see it the more I study. For years, I've taken Saul as a type of Antichrist. David is a type of Christ, but I miss the challenge, the contrasting picture. Be a type of Antichrist or be a type of Christ. There's no middle ground. And you realize that we're not types of Christ in exactly the same way in which the Bible writers were. But we are either types of Christ on one hand or we are types of Antichrist on the other. If you want a good clincher prayer for the book of Micah, you've got it here. Lord, make me a type of Christ, not a type of Antichrist. And there's no middle ground between those two things. Now, at the beginning of Micah, pause and ask yourself this question. What's the main thing God is seeking to accomplish in our lives through the book of Micah? Now, I believe the answer is this. He is seeking to give us a hatred of self-rule and a love for Christ-rule.
a hatred for self-rule and a love for Christ. Now you see, that applies to my own individual life. Just a hatred for any idea of trying to rule myself, trying to rule my own life. And then it applies to my outlook upon the world in general. How do you react to things you read in the newspaper? Do you have a hatred for self-rule in all of its different manifestations? A great many preachers don't. A great many preachers today are lining up with self-rule over against Christ's rule. That's the great thing God is seeking to accomplish in our lives. Here's a check as to whether we really get the message of Micah in our souls. Is self-rule utterly repulsive to you? The idea of your ruling yourself in any way and the idea of man ruling himself in any way, is it utterly repulsive to you? If it isn't, then you haven't really gotten into the message of Micah. Because the great thing God's seeking to accomplish is to give us a hatred for self-rule and a love for Christ's rule. In order to drive home this truth, I'd like for you to review with me for a moment these various books that we've been studying, what the main thing God is seeking to accomplish in our lives through each. Through Hosea, through Joel, through Amos, through Obadiah, through Jonah, and now through Micah. All right, let's review for a moment. Through the book of Hosea, he's seeking to make us compassionate, broken-hearted Christians. Through the book of Joel, he's seeking to make us Day of Jehovah Christians. What is a Day of Jehovah Christian? A Day of Jehovah Christian is one whose life is completely saturated with the sovereignty of God. Through Amos, he's seeking to make us passionately righteous Christians. Not merely those who have a little faint desire for righteousness, but those who have a passionate desire for righteousness. Through the book of Obadiah, he's seeking to make us humble, pride-heeding Christians. Nobody's humble if he doesn't hate pride. Through Jonah, he's seeking to make us missionary Christians. In order to be missionary Christians, we have to have the missionary heart of God instead of the anti-missionary heart of man. Now, what about Micah? Well, you know what we've been saying. Through Micah, God is seeking to make us Christ-ruled, not self-ruled Christians. As I showed you earlier, this is a point right back to all these other things we've been discussing. How can I be a compassionate, broken-hearted Christian by being a Christ-ruled Christian? How can I be a Day of Jehovah Christian, one whose life is just saturated with the sovereignty of God, by being a Christ-ruled Christian? How can I be passionately righteous by being a Christ-ruled Christian? A humble, pride-hating Christian, a missionary Christian, by being Christ-ruled Christian. So I believe that's the great thing God is seeking to accomplish in our lives through Micah. Summarize it, what's the distinctive contribution of Micah? Its contribution is that of all the books in the Bible, it's the most compact summary of the contrast between self-rule and Christ-rule. Our fifth principle is to study Micah as an example of true preaching. I want to mention one distinctive principle of preaching I find in the book of Micah, and I wonder if any of you have given this same one. Preach the social applications of the gospel. That's the first part. Preach the social applications of the gospel. Let me say to you again, many fundamentalists do not. Many fundamentalists are running away from the social gospel, a misnomer, and they don't preach the social applications of the gospel. Oh, don't run away from it, young people. If you do, you're running away from part of the whole counsel of God. But here's the finish of it. Preach the social applications of the gospel in terms of Christ's rule, not in terms of self-rule. in terms of Christ's rule, not in terms of self-rule. Let me draw this twofold diagram which shows the difference between the social applications of the gospel in Micah and the so-called social gospel of the modern.
Look at the difference between the two. Here's the message of Micah, the social applications of the gospel. Like, here's your foundation. It's Christ's rule. And then built on that is social application. Now, what's the difference between that message of Micah and the so-called social gospel of the modern?
Well, here's the difference, of course. Here's the message of modern. It's just the social gospel. And you see, it has no foundation to it. And it can't be effective.
You don't really solve any social problem until you get down to Christ's rule. Christ's rule is the absolute essential to solving social problems. But now why? If you have Christ's rule, then you don't neglect social problems. You see, if we neglect these social applications, we don't really have Christ's rule. If that's true, and I know it's true, it really does hit hard fundamentalism. Because a lot of fundamentalists just completely leave out the social applications of the gospel. It's strange that modernists should quote from Micah, because as I showed you before, they leave out this. They leave out the very foundation that Micah is driving at. Let me mention this, that it's all important to remember that no social problems are really solved apart from Christ's rule. And today, many are trying to solve social problems through self-rule. Now, here's a great catch. Ground your emphasis on social problems. Encourage self-rule, or does it encourage Christ's rule? Oh, there's a great catch. And you read the newspaper, and you'll find there are an awful lot of emphasis on social problems today is encouraging self-rule. Encourage self-rule. And all young people, don't encourage self-rule. But on the other hand, if you've got Christ's rule, then you must not neglect the social applications of the gospel. What about if some preacher today would just preach to a Sunday morning congregation from Micah 3, 1 to 3, that picture of cannibalism in extreme form, and then really apply it, and let church officers know that they can just be like a bunch of wild cannibals in the way in which they treat colored people and the way in which they treat various parts of society. You know, today we're having another one of these strikes in General Electric, and isn't it sad that people have to strike to get things? Now, I don't know just how righteous the demands are or aren't. I don't know. But I do know this. Theoretically, I'd be against labor unions. Theoretically. But practically, I'm not sure I'm completely against them. Because with this awful capitalism which crushes, see, that's the element of truth in what communists are talking about. Of course, we don't believe in communism. But there's so much unrighteous capitalism. Micah strikes at the nerve center of that. So let me summarize it. The distinctive principle of preaching that I find in Micah is preach the social applications of the gospel in terms of Christ's rule, but not in terms of self-rule. That's one place where a lot of our riots are coming from today. We're preaching social things just to stimulate self-rule rather than to stimulate Christ's rule. Did you have a comment or question? It would be illegal for them.
Be legal.
I did just catch a glance at that. I haven't read my paper yet. I read my morning paper after 5. Yeah, I buy it over at Brantford's where we eat our breakfast, and then I read it later. But she wants it to be legal to buy marijuana. That's critical stuff. Oh, sure.
You said that marijuana wasn't as harmful as tobacco.
tobacco and so forth, see, is whether you ought to buy that.
Well, I'm going to sell them all, but if I add another one, there's
sure.
I add both salt and so on.
That's right. Sure. Now on page 81, let's come to the seventh principle and pick up the other one next time. Trace the central message of Micah in detail throughout the entire book. Please read carefully Micah 1:1, the word of Jehovah that came to Micah, the Moreshite, in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. I want you to notice especially that name Ahaz, A-H-A-Z. Ahaz was one of the most wicked kings of the southern kingdom. This might be easy for you to remember. Ahaz in the southern kingdom and Ahab in the northern kingdom. Ahab, the most wicked king of the northern kingdom. Ahaz, the most wicked king of the southern kingdom in the overall picture. Some might mention one exception to that, and that exception is Manasseh, who came towards the end and ruled for 55 years. But the reason why I class Ahaz as worse than Manasseh is that Manasseh repented at the end and Ahaz didn't. And that makes a great difference between them. Now just remember, Micah is in those days of the most wicked of all the kings of the southern kingdom. Show how this opening verse sounds the keynote of the book of Micah. Well, we've mentioned the awful, wicked background of the days when Micah prophesied. And then this verse sounds the keynote because it stresses both kingdoms. You know, it says, in the days of the kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. I told you earlier that Micah is the only one of the major or minor prophets to direct his prophecy specifically against both kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. Would you underscore the opening statement of this next paragraph? One of the most distinguishing features of Micah is his two remarkable predictions concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. By using any previous knowledge or reference works you deem necessary, show how the following prophecies have been fulfilled. Chapter 1, verse 6, therefore I will make Samaria as a heap of the field, and as places for planting vineyards. And I will pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I will uncover the foundations thereof.
Now one thing that makes that so remarkable is that it happened in 722 B.C. And it's still true in 1969 A.D. at the present time.
Told you in other connections that in 1934 I had a visit to Palestine. And one thing my dad had been reading about a great deal. Dad was a great student of Bible history and Bible geography. He just loved anything that ever hit it. And geography. And was the ruins of ancient Samaria. And so he said to the guide when we came near there, he said, now that's one thing I'm looking forward to, is seeing the ruins of ancient Samaria. And the guide said, well, it'll be quite all right to me, Mr. Sells, if you want to go, but I advise you against it. The reason he advised against it was my dad had heart trouble and gonopectorous. In fact, he died just a little over a year after we got back from Palestine. He died in November of 1935, and we got back in August of 1934. And in Jerusalem, I was deeply concerned because he had high blood pressure. Jerusalem, 2,600 feet above sea level. He just tried to go everywhere all the rest of us went. He had to quit that. And so the man said, I can take it if you want to, but I strongly advise against it. Because it's just a massive ruin. All the stones poured out into the valley and everything like that. Well, you see, that was 1934, and the same thing is true now in 1969. With that in mind, just listen while I reread this. I will make Samaria as a heap of the field, and his places for planting vineyards, and I'll pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I'll uncover the foundations thereof. Fulfilled in 722 B.C., but still true in 1969 A.D. Then what about this prophecy concerning the destruction of Jerusalem? Therefore shall Zion, for your sake, be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heath, and the mountain of the house as the high places of a forest. Now, before I show you the threefold way this was fulfilled, I want you to compare Micah 3:12 with Jeremiah 26, verses 18 and 19. If you compare Micah 3:12 with Jeremiah 26, 18 and 19, you'll see that this prophecy was used of God to save Jeremiah's life. See, Jeremiah predicted the coming destruction of Jerusalem, and they were ready to put him to death. But somebody protected him and preserved his life by saying, "Well, don't put him to death, because the prophet before him prophesied the same thing." So you call out the prophecy of Micah. And isn't that an interesting thing, that the prophecy of Micah was used of God to save the life of Jeremiah? Jeremiah 26, verses 18 and 19. Now, one reason why this is so important is, it's definite evidence that Micah prophesied before the event transpired. You see, a modernist, the destructive critic, would try to say, "Oh yeah, he prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem, but he was living after Jerusalem was destroyed." Well, if so, then how do you explain the fact that this prophecy was used to save the life of Jeremiah, who was living clearly at the time when Jerusalem was destroyed? And you see, a comparison, though, shows clearly that Micah was a prophet, not a historian. He wasn't writing what had already happened as though it was prophecy. But he was predicting what was in the future, and his prophecy was used of God to save the life of Jeremiah. That is a threefold fulfillment of this prophecy concerning the destruction of Zion, the destruction of Jerusalem. The first part of it is 587 B.C. when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. But he did not completely fulfill the prophecy. The next time is 70 A.D. when Titus, the Roman general in 70 A.D., destroyed Jerusalem. But he did not completely fulfill the prophecy. I wonder if anybody knows the name of the Roman emperor. You see, Titus was the Roman general, not the emperor. He was under the Roman emperor. Roman emperor, I think, was Vespasian. But he was the Roman general. But there was a Roman emperor who literally fulfilled all this. Tell you about it in a moment, and then reread the prophecy in terms of it. You know his name? He came in the year 132 to 135 A.D. And his name was Hadrian, the Roman Emperor. Now what happened was this. After Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 A.D., you'd naturally think the Jews would stay away from it, but they didn't. They loved their homeland with almost an infinite love and infinite longing. And so a great many more Jews came back again. When Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 A.D., he crucified 1.5 million Jews. But then Hadrian crucified 500,000 more Jews in 132 to 135 A.D. You remember reading about a Jewish leader, a false messiah named Bar Kokhba, B-A-R-C-O-C-H-B-A. Bar means son, and Kokhba means star, the son of a star. And it takes you back to Numbers 24:17, which prophesies that Christ will be the star out of Jacob. And Bar Kokhba led them back. And again, there were thousands and thousands of Jews back in Jerusalem. And then Hadrian, the Roman emperor, invaded. And this time, he literally fulfilled the prophecy in Micah. Look at it and see what he did. Therefore shall Zion, for your sake, be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps. He literally did that. He literally ran his plowshares through Jerusalem. Because he said, "Well, we destroyed Jerusalem back in the time of Titus, and the Jews are still back there again. I'm going to fix it so they won't be back there anymore." And he literally fulfilled it. Now that's wonderful prophecy when you realize that Micah prophesied sometime before 700 B.C. And this prophecy is realized between 132 and 135 A.D. All right, we have just time to take our sixth principle up at the top of the page. From a quick glance through Micah and Isaiah, from a comparison of Micah 1:1 with Isaiah 1:1, how Micah and Isaiah are interrelated. Well, of course, a comparison of the first verse of each book shows that they were contemporaries. They lived and prophesied at the same time. There are two chief differences between them. I'll mention one, and you see if you can mention the other. The first difference between them is that Isaiah was a city prophet. He's what you call a city man. We often refer to Isaiah as a statesman prophet. He was a great Christian statesman. Isaiah was the country prophet. Here are your two great country prophets. One is Amos and the other is Micah. And that's one difference between them. Micah's a country prophet, prophesying at the same time with Isaiah, the city prophet. Have you ever noticed that combination in God's plan for today? I'm thinking especially of the contrast between my friend Dan Graham, to whom I often refer, and Dr. Bob King, that I refer to as my pastor. Dr. King was a Phi Beta Kappa. Went to school, he got his Phi Beta Kappa, and he was that type of preacher. He had a heart for the masses of people. But he was pastor of what's called a downtown city church. Well, Dan Graham has a real approach to the up and out, but his primary approach is not that. His primary approach is to the down and out. His primary approach is on the line of the country people. And those two men just love one another. They work right together in the work of the Lord. And that one difference you find between them, the city prophet over against the country prophet. And then the second is, see if you could tell me, what main difference do you find between the book of Isaiah and the book of Micah? Well, of course, it sort of gives itself away when you have the length of each book. And the difference is that Isaiah is much broader in its sweep than Micah. Micah is much more restrictive than Isaiah. And of course, that calls attention to what we call the concentration value. Enables you to concentrate in a special way on the message of Micah. And the great message of Micah is Christ through the cure for suffering. Christ through the cure for suffering. All right, let's have our closing prayer.